Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program number 329, Connecting the Dots, Evidentiary Tributaries Between Elements That Either Were Directly Involved in or Impinge on the Terrorist Blitzkrieg of September 11th of 2001. This is being recorded on October 7th of the year 2001. On side one of this program, we talked about, among other things, the Wahhabi sect in Saudi Arabia, something we're going to be talking about at considerable length in this half. We spoke about the historical links connecting the Wahhabi sect with international fascism, British fascist Jack Philby, Alan Dulles, the Third Reich, and we also talked about the connections between the Bin Laden family and the Bush family. Specifically, we spoke about the fact that Salem Bin Laden, Osama's older brother, was represented in North America by James R. Bath, allegedly connected to both the CIA and the milieu of the BCCI. James R. Bath, in turn, put up roughly 5% of the capital for George W.'s first oil company, and people who knew him at the time said he didn't have much money of his own, and that in all likelihood that capital came from his wealthy Saudi clients, which would include the Bin Laden family. Whether or not the money came from the Bin Laden family, their North American business representative, James R. Bath, did help to finance Arbusto Energy, George W.'s first oil company. In For the Record program number 284 and later in For the Record 315, we talked about the Carlyle Group. That's a very prestigious international investment firm which counts among its participants the elder George Bush, as well as Secretary of State, former Secretary of State James Baker, and ex-Secretary of State Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci, himself deeply connected to the milieu of the Iran-Contra scandal. An article in the Wall Street Journal that appeared on Thursday, September 27th of the year 2001, not only talked about the link between James R. Bath and the Bin Laden family and George W. Bush, but beyond that, it mentioned that the Bin Laden family are heavily involved with the Carlyle Group, which in turn is connected to, again, the elder George Bush, James Baker, and Frank Carlucci, among others. Research credit on this goes to a member of the listening audience who alerted me to the existence of this article. I then went home and began reading my unread Wall Street journals because there's been so much news it's been hard to keep up. And lo and behold, here is the following from the Wall Street Journal of Thursday, September 27th of the year 2001. This is an article by Daniel Golden and James Bandler and Marcus Walker of the Wall Street Journal. Again, this is from September 27th of 2001. It's headlined, Bin Laden Family is Tied to U.S. Group. And that U.S. group, of course, the Carlyle Group, connected to the elder George Bush and people from his administration. And it's a very interesting connection indeed. One of the capital participants in the Carlyle Group is the Bin Laden family, which makes the Bin Laden family business partners with the elder George Bush as well as the younger. The article reads in part, if the U.S. boosts defense spending in its quest to stop Osama bin Laden's alleged terrorist activities, there may be one unexpected beneficiary, Mr. bin Laden's family. Among its far-flung business interests, the well-heeled Saudi Arabian clan, which says it is estranged from Osama, I would add, take that with a grain of salt, is an investor in a fund established by Carlyle Group, a well-connected Washington merchant bank specializing in buyouts of defense and aerospace companies. Through this investment and its ties to Saudi royalty, the Bin Laden family has become acquainted with some of the biggest names in the Republican Party. In recent years, former President Bush, ex-Secretary of State James Baker, and ex-Secretary of Defense Frank Carlucci have made the pilgrimage to the Bin Laden family's headquarters in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. Mr. Bush makes speeches on behalf of Carlyle Group and is senior advisor to its Asian Partners Fund, while Mr. Baker is its senior counselor. Mr. Carlucci is the group's chairman. And I would add that during the campaign last year, as we looked at in For the Record 284 and 315, the elder Bush was in touch with the King of Saudi Arabia. Continuing, Osama is one of more than 50 children of Mohammed bin Laden, who built the family's $5 billion business, Saudi Bin Laden Group, largely with construction contracts from the Saudi government. I would add that Mohammed bin Laden and King Ibn Saud had children that were married to... Mohammed bin Laden was an in-law of King Ibn Saud, just as Mullah Omar, the head of the Taliban, is married to one of Osama bin Laden's daughters, which makes Osama Mullah Omar's father-in-law. Continuing, Osama worked briefly in the business and is believed to have inherited as much as $50 million from his father in cash and stock, although he doesn't have access to the shares, the family spokesman says. Because his Saudi citizenship was revoked in 1994, Mr. bin Laden is ineligible to own assets in the kingdom, the spokesman said. The bin Laden family has long disavowed Osama and has cooperated fully with several federal investigations into his activity. I would take that, by the way, with a grain of salt. Continuing, the family business headed by Osama's half-brother, Bakir, B-A-K-R, epitomizes the U.S.-Saudi alliance that the suspected terrorist often rails against. After the 1996 truck bombing in Dhahran, Saudi Arabia, that killed 19 U.S. servicemen, Saudi bin Laden Group built military barracks and airfields for U.S. troops. Skipping down, of the direct participation of the bin Laden family in Carlyle Group, a Carlyle executive said the bin Laden family committed $2 million to a London investment arm in 1995 in Carlyle Partners II Fund, which raised $1.3 billion overall. The fund has purchased several aerospace companies among 29 deals. So far, the family has received $1.3 million back in completed investments and should ultimately realize a 40% annualized rate of return, the Carlyle executive said. But a foreign financier with ties to the bin Laden family says the family's overall investment with Carlyle is considerably larger. He called the $2 million merely an initial contribution. Quote, "It's like plowing a field," unquote, this person said, again quoting, "You seed it once, you plow it, and then you reseed it again," unquote. The Carlyle executive added that he would think twice before accepting any future investments by the bin Ladens, quote, "The situation's changed now," he said. "I don't want to spend my life talking to reporters," unquote. And skipping down again, in addition to what we have just seen as illustrating the connections between the elder George Bush as well as James Baker and Frank Carlucci with the bin Laden family, the connection between James R. Bath and George W. Bush is mentioned here. Skipping down, there is no indication President George W. Bush has met any of the bin Ladens, but he was indirectly linked to one of them 2 decades ago. His longtime friend James W. Bath, that's actually James R. Bath, I believe, who met Mr. Bush when they were both pilots in the Air National Guard, acted as a Texas business representative for Osama's older brother, Salem bin Laden, from 1976 to 1988, when Salem died in a plane crash. Mr. Bath bought several real estate contributions and other deals to Salem bin Laden, an ebullient man who headed the family construction business. Mr. Bath generally received a 5% interest as his fee and was sometimes listed as a trustee in related corporate documents. Again, the James R. Bath investment in George W.'s Arbusto Energy is a matter of public record, not only the book Fortunate Son by J.H. Hatfield, but also Pete Bruton's The Mafia, the CIA Mafia, and George Bush document that connection. Note that Salem bin Laden, Osama's older brother, was killed in a plane crash in 1988 when the elder George Bush was running for president and when a lot of people died in plane crashes, including the McKee team, a U.S. military intelligence team, members of which allegedly became aware not only of the George H.W. Bush Iran-Contra team connection to Manzar al-Qasar, but also Charles McKee. Major McKee was a witness to a meeting in the King David Hotel in Jerusalem at which many of the Iran-Contra machinations were set forth. Amiram Nir Nisker, another participant in that meeting, was also killed in a plane crash in 88. In side one of this program, we took a look at the connections again between King Ibn Saud, the founder of Saudi Arabia, and the ultra-conservative Wahhabi sect and British fascist Jack Philby and the Third Reich, and beyond that, Alan Dulles, the former CIA director, OSS operative, lawyer for Sullivan and Cromwell, and key participant in the Nazi American money plot before, during, and after World War II. Alan Dulles, in addition to being connected with Ibn Saud and the Third Reich, thereby a participant in this decades-long money connection that we've been talking about. Alan Dulles was also the corporate lawyer hired to set up the Harriman 15 holding company, which George Herbert Walker and Prescott Bush Sr., the great-grandfather and grandfather, respectively, of George W. Bush, participated. And we've talked about that in numerous broadcasts, including For the Record programs 186 and 248. Reprising a section of the book The Secret War Against the Jews, How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, co-authored by former military intelligence officer and lawyer John Loftus with a high security clearance. Loftus actually got permission from the CIA to print this book, and he has the power of attorney for a number of former British, American, and Soviet intelligence operatives who reading between the lines, appear to have been working for a truly pro-American and democratic, with a small d, element of the CIA who wanted to get the truth out about this material. The CIA, like the rest of the national security establishment, is not a monolith. Elements of it and many people in it are truly admirable, democratic, and with a small d, and pro-American, but unfortunately they are outgunned, outflanked, and outmanned. Now, the key here is to understand the connections, as we looked at inside one of the broadcasts, between Ibn Saud and the Third Reich and Alan Dulles. And here we're going to look at the relationship between the Third Reich and Alan Dulles and the Bush family. Loftus and Ahrens write, in The Secret War Against the Jews, hard and soft cover edition, St. Martin's Press, copyright 1994, instead of divesting the Nazi money, Bush hired a lawyer to hide the assets. The lawyer he hired had considerable expertise in such underhanded schemes. It was Alan Dulles. According to Dulles' client list at Sullivan and Cromwell, his first relationship with Brown Brothers Harriman was on June 18, 1936. In January of 1937, Dulles listed his work for the firm as, quote, disposal of Standard Oil investing stock, unquote. As discussed in Chapter 3, Standard Oil of New Jersey had completed a major stock transaction with Dulles' Nazi client, I.G. Farben. By the end of January 1937, Dulles had merged all his cloaking activities into one client account, Brown Brothers Harriman Schroeder Rock, unquote. Schroeder, of course, was the Nazi bank on whose board Dulles sat. The Rock were the Rockefellers of Standard Oil, who were already coming under scrutiny for their Nazi deals. By May of 1939, Dulles handled another problem for Brown Brothers Harriman, their, quote, securities custodian accounts, unquote. If Dulles was trying to conceal how many Nazi holding companies Brown Brothers Harriman was connected with, he did not do a very good job. Shortly after Pearl Harbor, word leaked from Washington that affiliates of Prescott Bush's company were under investigation for aiding the Nazis in time of war. In February of 1942, George Bush's father, who was then the senior managing partner of Brown Brothers Harriman, tried to wrap himself in the American flag, skipping down. Under the Trading with the Enemy Act, all the shares of the Union Banking Corporation were seized, including those held by Prescott Bush, as being, in effect, held for enemy nationals. Union Banking, of course, was an affiliate of Brown Brothers Harriman, and Bush handled the Harriman's investments as well. By the way, the post-war liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation provided the foundation for the Bush family fortune. That took place in 1951 and would therefore have been conducted under the auspices of the Bormann Group. We looked at that in For the Record 273. Continuing. Once the government had its hands on Bush's books, the whole story of the intricate web of Nazi front corporations began to unravel. A few days later, two of Union Banking's subsidiaries, the Holland American Trading Corporation and the Seamless Steel Equipment Corporation, also were seized. Then the government went after the Harriman 15 holding company, which Bush shared with his father-in-law, Bert Walker, the Hamburg America Line, and the Silesian American Corporation. The U.S. government found that huge sections of Prescott Bush's empire had been operated on behalf of Nazi Germany and had greatly assisted the German war effort. So again, with Alan Dulles, we have a direct link between King Ibn Saud, an in-law of Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, and the Third Reich, and the Bush family, and both Georges Bush, as we have seen, have business connections to the Bin Laden family. Now, one of the points that I have tried to make in connection with the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th of 2001, it's a point others have made, is that the behavior of Bin Laden and the other Islamic extremists is not characteristic of or an accurate doctrinal representation of Islam. Indeed, the Wahhabis are a pro-fascist, at least from an historical functional standpoint, a pro-fascist element with Islam or within Islam that in turn were elevated by the British in the World War I period, by the Nazis in the pre-World War II period, and in conjunction with the Nazis, American petroleum interests in the World War II and post-World War II periods. And again, we've looked at that in, among other broadcasts, For the Record, Program 216, and we reviewed the Wahhabi connections in other broadcasts as well, including Side 1 of this program. Now, there is a very fine article which was researched for us by Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, which discusses not only the Wahhabi sect and how different it is from true Islam, but it also discusses the strong ideological affiliations between Wahhabism and fascism. And in fact, the author of this article, Stephen Schwartz, refers to the Wahhabi philosophy and that of Osama bin Laden as Islamo-fascism. And I want to emphasize this because it is very important not to confuse Osama bin Laden and the Wahhabis and this powerful element within Islam with true Islam, but rather it would be more accurately referred to as Islamo-fascism. Again, research credit on the following goes to Dave White, our pan-European researcher and translator, who got the following from The Spectator, a British magazine, not to be confused with the American Spectator. This is from The Spectator of September 22nd of the year 2001. It's by Stephen Schwartz, and it's called Ground Zero and the Saudi Connection. Subtitled, Stephen Schwartz on the Extreme Islamic Sect that Inspires Osama bin Laden as Well as All Muslim Suicide Bombers and is Subsidized by Saudi Arabia. And Saudi Arabia is one of the links between what I call the Underground Reich and what we're seeing abroad and in the United States, as is the Bush family. This article is Dateline Washington and reads, skipping down, the Islamo-fascist ideology of Osama bin Laden and those closest to him, such as the Egyptian and Algerian Islamic groups, unquote, is no more intrinsically linked to Islam or Islamic civilization than Pearl Harbor was to Buddhism, or Ulster terrorists, whatever they may profess, are to Christianity. Serious Christians don't go around killing and maiming the innocent. Devout Muslims do not prepare for paradise by hanging out in strip bars and getting drunk, as one of last week's terrorist pilots was reported to have done, skipping down. Still, the numerical preponderance of Muslims as perpetrators of these ghastly incidents is no coincidence. So we have to ask ourselves, what has made these men into the monsters they are? What has so galvanized violent tendencies in the world's second largest religion and in America the fastest growing faith? Can it really flow from a quarrel over a bit of land in the Middle East? Skipping down. If you ask educated, pious, traditional but forward-looking Muslims what has driven their Ummah, UMMA, or global community in this direction, many of them will answer you with one word, Wahhabism. This is a strain of Islam that emerged not at the time of the Crusades, nor even at the time of the anti-Turkish wars of the 17th century, but less than two centuries ago. It is violent, it is intolerant, and it is fanatical beyond measure. It originated in Arabia, and it is the official theology of the Gulf states. Wahhabism is the most extreme form of Islamic fundamentalism, and its followers are called Wahhabis. And skipping down on the history of Wahhabism and its deep schism with and rejection by real mainstream Muslims, Wahhabism is the Islamic equivalent of the most extreme Protestant sectarianism. It is Puritan, demanding punishment for those who enjoy any form of music except the drum, and severe punishment up to death for drinking or sexual transgressions. It condemns as unbelievers those who do not pray, a view that never previously existed in mainstream Islam. It is stripped-down Islam, calling for simple, short prayers, undecorated mosques, and the uprooting of gravestones, since decorated mosques and graveyards lend themselves to veneration, which is idolatry in the Wahhabi mind. Wahhabis do not even permit the name of the Prophet Muhammad to be inscribed in mosques, nor do they allow his birthday to be celebrated. Above all, they hate ostentatious spirituality, much as Protestants detest the veneration of miracles and saints in the Roman Church. Ibn Abdul Wahhab, 1703-92, the founder of the totalitarian Islamism, was born in Ugayna, U-G-A-Y-N-A-H, in the part of Arabia known as Najd, N-E-J-D, where Riyadh is today, and which the Prophet himself notably warned would be a source of corruption and confusion. Note that, and I may be mispronouncing these names. Anti-Wahhabi Muslims refer to Wahhabism as Fitna'an Najdaya, or the trouble out of Najd. From the beginning of Wahhab's dispensation in the late 18th century, his cult was associated with mass murder of all who opposed it. For example, the Wahhabis fell upon the city of Karbala in 1801 and killed 2,000 ordinary citizens in the streets and markets. Skipping down again, Bin Laden is a Wahhabi. So are the suicide bombers in Israel. So are his Egyptian allies, who exulted as they stabbed foreign tourists to death at Luxor not many years ago, bathing in blood up to their elbows and emitting blasphemous cries of ecstasy. So are the Algerian Islamist terrorists, whose contribution to the purification of the world consisted of murdering people for such sins as running a movie projector or reading secular newspapers. So are the Taliban-style guerrillas in Kashmir who murder Hindus. The Iranians are not Wahhabis, which partially explains their slow but undeniable movement towards moderation and normality after a period of utopian and Puritan revivalism. But the Taliban practice a variant of Wahhabism. In the Wahhabi fashion, they employ ancient punishments such as execution for moral offenses, and they have a primitive and fearful view of women. The same is true of Saudi Arabia's rulers. But none of this extremism has been inspired by American fumblings in the world, and it has little to do with the tragedies that have beset Israelis and Palestinians. Skipping down. And that is the point that must be understood. Bin Laden and other Wahhabis are not defending Islamic tradition. They represent an ultra-radical break in the direction of a sectarian utopia. Thus, they are best described as Islamo-fascists, although they have much in common with Bolsheviks. Then the writer goes on to talk about the fact that it is Saudi Arabia that is the main promoter of Islamic fundamentalism, or Wahhabism in this case, and that it is the oil connection between the United States and Saudi Arabia and parts of the rest of the world that keeps this obscured. Also note that largely because of the American-Saudi connection, according to this article, many of the imams in Islamic mosques in the United States are Wahhabis, so note that. The Bengali Sufi writer Zishan Ali has described the situation touchingly, quote, "Muslims from Bangladesh and the U.S., just like any other place in the world, uphold their traditional beliefs of Islam, but, due to lack of instruction, keep quiet when their beliefs are attacked by Wahhabis in the U.S. who all of a sudden become, quote, better, unquote, Muslims than others. These Wahhabis go even further and accuse their own fathers of heresy, sin, and unbelief. And the young children of the immigrants, when they grow up in this country, get exposed only to this one-sided version of Islam and are led to think that this is the only Islam. Naturally, a big gap is being created every day that silence is only widening," unquote. The young, divided between tradition and the call of the new, opt for Islamic revolution, unquote, and commit themselves to their self-destruction combined with mass murder. The same influences are brought to bear throughout the 10 million strong Muslim community in America, as well as those in Europe. In the U.S., 80% of mosques are estimated by the Sufi Hisham al-Kabani, born in Lebanon and now living in the U.S., to be under the control of Wahhabi imams who preach extremism, and this leads to the other point of vulnerability. Washington is subsidized by Saudi Arabia, even though Bin Laden has sworn to destroy the Saudi royal family. The Saudis have played a double game for years, more or less as Stalin did with the West during the Second World War. They pretended to be allies in a common struggle against Saddam Hussein, while they spread Wahhabi ideology everywhere Muslims are to be found, just as Stalin promoted an anti-fascist, unquote, coalition with the U.S. while carrying out espionage and subversion on American territory. The motive was the same, the belief that the West was or is decadent and doomed. One major question is never asked in American discussions of Arab terrorism: what is the role of Saudi Arabia? The question cannot be asked because American companies depend too much on the continued flow of Saudi oil, while American politicians have become too cozy with the Saudi rulers. Another reason it is not asked is that to expose the extent of Saudi and Wahhabi influence on American Muslims, which would deeply compromise many Islamic clerics in the U.S. But it is the most significant question Americans should be asking themselves today. If we get rid of bin Laden, who do we then have to deal with? The answer was eloquently put by Syed Vali Reza Nazer, professor of political science at the University of California at San Diego, and author of an authoritative volume on Islamic extremism in Pakistan, when he said, quote, "If the U.S. wants to do something about radical Islam, it has to deal with Saudi Arabia. The, quote, rogue states, unquote, Iraq, Libya, etc., are less important in the radicalization of Islam than Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the single most important cause and supporter of radicalization, ideologization, and the general fanaticism of Islam." And obviously this is a long discussion. We will be taking it up in future broadcasts. I'm going to review a section that we took a look at in For the Record 328. This comes from The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, published in hardcover by Little Brown, copyright 1997. And this alludes to the World Muslim Congress, founded by Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti, himself a major in the SS, and a key player in the post-World War II Muslim world, and the Afghan support effort, which saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden and Ramzi Youssef and Sheikh Rahman of the World Trade Center bombing number 1, and the Afghan support effort where much of this trouble originated. And note also the role of the Saudi royal family in what I'm about to read. IHR is the Institute of Historical Review, the top Holocaust denial institution. Another favorite IHR speaker and collaborator was Isa Naqlai of the World Muslim Congress, or WMC. Based in Pakistan, the WMC was initially headed by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who, like his friend H. Keith Thompson, stood by the Third Reich until his death in 1974. A few years later, the WMC, then headed by Pakistani Dr. Inamullah Khan, mailed Holocaust denial literature to every member of the U.S. Congress and the British Parliament. The WMC's official mouthpiece, Muslim World, carried ads for the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Henry Ford's The International Jew. Dr. Khan's Congress also published Freemasonry, a book warning that Jews were using lodge members to extend secret control over religion and society, a paranoid theory that has long been popular among Liberty Lobby supporters and neo-Nazi groups around the world. Acknowledging their political kinship, WMC Secretary General Khan sent a letter to the Spotlight praising its superb in-depth analysis, unquote, and stating that the paper deserved, quote, the thanks of all right-minded people, unquote. Dr. Khan also served as an advisor to the Saudi Arabian royal family, which lavished funds on the WMC. In addition, the Saudi Arabian government retained the services of American neo-Nazi William Grimstead as a Washington lobbyist. Like many European neo-fascist groups, the WMC adopted a third-position stance toward the superpowers. But Khan, skipping down, tempered his anti-American tirades when the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979. Soon, the World Muslim Congress began working closely with U.S. intelligence and Pakistani military officials who were covertly supporting the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet-installed regime in Kabul. This effort was strongly endorsed by Dr. Khan, who served for many years as the Pakistani representative of the Nazi-infested World Anti-Communist League, which played an important role in the Reagan administration's, quote, secret war, unquote, in the Golden Crescent. So the Saudi, Wahhabi, or Islamo-fascist, oil, Bush family, Underground Reich, Third Reich, Allen Dulles connection is one of the main nexuses to keep in mind as we look at the evolution of these terrible events. This concludes For the Record program number 329, Side B, being recorded on October 7th of the year 2001. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.